Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And it was very fortuitous that we talked about my caftan on Monday.
Well, I was going to say, Devin is not wearing caftan today. Monday was her caftan day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like Moo Moo Monday.
Moo Moo. Moo Moo Monday at Hellbent HQ.
I know. Now I need to get a Moo Moo / caftan.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Actually, I really want to do that.
Yeah, we should do that.
But anyway, it was super fortuitous, as Devin was saying, because when we finished recording, put out the episode, then there were photos all over the internet of Hillary Clinton wearing this like a beautiful like blue, like sky blue.
Like caftan.
Caftan, for, I think at a wedding.
A wedding. She looked so glorious.
Like yeah. I wasn't even like hard sold on caftans
right.
until that moment.
You're
I was like need that caftan.
Yeah.
Like it was so, I love the color on her. It was perfect.
It was perfect.
So yeah, I guess we gotta implement Moo Moo Mondays.
Moo Moo Mondays. They are comfortable as fuck.
That means I have to get multiple Moo Moos though. So that, you know,
we can
switch
rotate
it up.
For sure.
Also on the sort of like fashion and Hillary Clinton vein, one of our listeners, Varsha, tweeted us. And she had a photo of this like glorious t-shirt that I think you can get on Amazon of Hillary Clinton riding a unicorn in front of the White House in this like magnificent robe, and then like Bill's in the background
playing sax,
which I didn't notice at first. Yeah. I was like, I need all of these things.
I know.
And a bunch of people were like, I know what I'm getting spray painted on my car.
Yeah, right.
Or, like, airbrushed on my
car.
Yeah,
my new tattoo.
It's just Hillary Clinton on a unicorn.
Unicorn, yeah.
Like, just like go full for it.
I know.
Like not even try to pretend.
It's
like
so
just
good.
Go for it.
I know. I found myself wearing a lot more of the like political, like, humor and political t-shirts.
Graphic tees
and, you know,
like
the
things that say it's fuck the shit o'clock.
Yeah. Yep. I wonder why that would be.
Yeah. Definitely not subtle times.
Our
merch certainly isn't subtle.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into our show. I know
okay.
We like to bullshit at the top, but time to get real serious.
Sarah's really concerned about time in this episode. Last night she was like, girl, cut this shit down.
You know the ironic thing about you talking about how concerned about time I am,
yeah,
is you're taking up more time.
Okay,
it's
all
like
right.
Stressing me out. Okay, so here's what we're going to talk about today. So as always, we start with listener feedback and some updates on our end. Block two, not a perma block.
No.
Temporary block. It's called Doomsday Prepping and Pre-Dawn Door Knocking. And we're going to be talking about Paul Manafort and how FBI agents raided his home recently. And then also, we're going to be talking about North Korea. I don't even have, like, a summary of what's happening. It's just bananas. We have a whole thing. Then, of course, we go into our interview. And this week, we're going to be chatting with Melissa McEwen. You might recognize her as Shakes Tweets on Twitter. She also is the founder and creator of the blog Shakesville. And we're going to be talking to her about Mike motherfucking Pence.
Literally, Mike motherfucking Pence.
We're really excited to talk to her about that. Then, as always, we follow that up with our gratitude check. And then, because it's Thursday, we do our Maxine Waters update and Maxine Waters award in badassery. And then finally, to cap everything off, we've got some action items, so stuff you can do after you listen to the show.
Okay, Sarah, so let's start off with some listener feedback, and this first one is amazing, so why don't you tell us about it?
So first of all, I have to give a major shout out to one of our Hellions, also a Sarah, who memeified one of my quotes in the latest podcast in an assortment of, like, very glorious ways. So the quote that inspired her was me saying, I have a podcast, I have a high horse. Let me tell you some shit.
Yep.
And so all the memes, which you can find in our Facebook group, are variations of horses, like, doing the funniest shit. And, like, I just can't stop laughing.
It's really funny.
Like, one of them is a horse who is literally high off pot, which felt super appropriate because when she posted about them, I had just gotten my medical marijuana card.
We are peak millennials living in California.
I know. And I feel like I really buried the lead there. The funniest thing about that is that I've only ever tried, like, pot once in my life.
Yeah.
It was in college, and it was an edible,
uh-huh.
And I was, like, it wasn't fun at all. Like, I've never felt more unintelligent. I couldn't hold on a conversation.
Right.
I was antisocial, not because I didn't want to talk to people, but because I literally could not hold a conversation.
There were no words in my brain.
Yeah, I was, like, got the best sleep of my life.
Oh, yeah.
But But so it was interesting because when I went into the dispensary, I was like, I literally have no idea. Yeah. I was like such a noob. I'm like, please help me, Jackie. That was
the woman's name. Jackie, girl,
it's,
help
it's
me.
It's a whole journey, guys, or friends. It's a whole journey.
It totally
so anyway,
is.
Thank you to Sarah for just making me laugh and creating amazing memes.
They were really funny.
Yeah.
So Chelsea tweeted at us and said, quote, I'm starting from the beginning with Hellbent, and I literally forgot some of the shit that happened in January and February. And
oh my gosh.
Yes, hard agree. I'm afraid to go back and listen to everything because so much has already happened.
I know.
And there are things, like sometimes I'll go back and listen to like a random episode or look at a random old outline and I'm like, oh yeah.
Even shit that like happened recently, yeah. Like Don Jr., like the news of Don Jr. meeting with like a Russian lawyer to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. I'm like, that's just a blip in the radar now.
Seriously.
Like, what? Like, it's both been like the longest and shortest year of my life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it just feels like at every turn, it's like Don Jr. and this Russian lawyer meeting, and Paul Manafort's like, hold my beer. I'm going to have FBI guys raid my house. So, like, one upped you there.
I know. I think that, like, we're going to have to go back and listen to them all just to get, like, be like, oh, yeah, all this shit happened. And then at Mama Jean AB has a pronunciation correction for us. So she said, Catherine Cortez Masto is Masto, not Masto. She's my senator and a badass, the first Latina in the Senate ever. And thank you for that. I had heard it both ways, and I went with the incorrect one, because of course.
Yeah.
So thank you for the correction.
Yeah, welcome to my life. It's literally my life.
I know. We try really hard. So yeah. It's like, oh.
And Sarah's really good at it, and I'm really, really bad at it.
I always go on YouTube and find videos and try to make sure we're correct. And it doesn't always... Sometimes something slips through the cracks. So thank you, Mama Jean AB.
Yeah. Okay, so we got a really great email from Jennifer.
Yes.
That had some really great constructive feedback. So she said, quote, over the weekend, I caught up on a few episodes, and listening to them back to back made me notice something. Not sure if you ever noticed this, but when you talk about Maxine Waters, you use cute and adorable a lot to describe various things she said or done. And I just flagged that words like that are probably not the best choice for someone of her age, stature, and level of badassery, which you so gloriously call out every week. I probably noticed this because I've been called on it myself. Some language that's intended to show warmth and affection sometimes reads as condescending or feels diminutive to the listener. My solution has been to use words like delightful, endearing, and charming, which have the same affectionate feel, but with a more grown-up connotation. And this is such a great point and something that we really hadn't noticed, but it's a really good point. And I think being more precise anyway, like endearing and charming, is much better.
Is a good rule in general. So thank you to Jennifer for the note and for better and more appropriate suggestions on word choice. So that's really great. Kind of on a similar vein, we heard from Susan via our Patreon. She said, I started with some podcasts that were all male and then eventually found you friends. Now, here's where the feedback gets iffy, but I think it says more about me than you. At first, I didn't like your style. I think it's mostly related to never receiving news in a casual format from women before. And if I'm being honest, a fair bit of sexism. However, that quickly changed when I heard your content and also the way you model receiving constructive feedback. It has been a powerful lesson for me. Examples, coverage of Philando Castile verdict and merchandise sizing. You're never defensive. You're always polite. You make changes when warranted and explain yourselves when you chose not to change your behavior. Even when your behavior does not change, you give space for the feedback. I do not hear that ever in any of, I do not hear that ever in any of my all-male political podcasts. It is refreshing to get such detailed and well-researched information from women, especially when dissenting opinions are respected. Thank you for resisting and persisting and including us hellions in your journey. Keep up the outstanding work. It is greatly appreciated. Which I really appreciate that feedback.
Me too.
I was talking to a friend who's also a listener the other day, and she sort of made the same note that she like that was one thing that she really appreciated about us is that we like take feedback in stride.
Right.
And it was kind of like, I was like, I appreciate that, but I also feel like that's the least we could do.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So it's like, it is very telling that, you know, I remember reading something that women approach conversations to learn more.
Right.
To gain a better understanding, and men tend to approach conversations to win the argument.
Right.
Or to win the conversation. And I think about that a lot when I see men receive constructive criticism and then get like knee-jerk defensiveness. Right. I do wonder how much of that is the way we're conditioned.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I think that's a big part of it. Like, I think little girls are socialized. You even see it at the preschool level. Mm-hmm. Like, they're socialized to be more like
collaborative
and they do things together and they work in groups.
Yeah.
And
so it's really interesting. But I mean, yeah, we feel like it makes our podcast better. So we're always appreciative when you give us constructive critical feedback. And so thank you to Susan for that note. I mean, then speaking of Patreon, for our Patreon bonus pod, do you want to tell everyone what we're going to be talking about?
So we're going to be discussing military privatization and how we are being trained for democratic backsliding. The White House defends its silence on the mosque bombing in Minnesota, saying the story might have been made up by liberals.
Ugh.
Which, what? A DOJ reversal on voting rights. States can purge voter rolls without evidence they've moved.
They can purge voters from the rolls.
From the rolls. Yeah. Yes, thank you. And there is a really great, like, shocking story about pregnant women in prisons are still allowed to be and or required to be shackled during childbirth in 27 states.
Yeah.
Which is just a huge human rights violation.
For sure. And then, so not to hard sell our Patreon too much, but we're going to do it. But for the price of a fancy latte, so like $5, you can really make a difference in helping us keep the lights on.
Yeah.
We work really hard to make each podcast as sharp and informative as possible. So it would really mean a lot if you became one of our patrons. Plus, you get access to all kinds of extra content, like bonus pods, mm-hmm. where we really let our hair down.
It's true. It gets a little loose.
It gets a little tinfoil hat hairy.
It does. It's great. We also post a lot of, like, behind-the-scenes stuff. So, like,
Devin's whiteboard.
My whiteboard and us, like, laughing at nothing.
It's pretty special.
It's pretty special.
So we're only $100 away from our next goal. So if just 20 of you chip in $5, we'll get there. And I'll also say that we do allocate money to patronize other creators.
Yes.
Especially women and just members of underrepresented groups in general. So right now we have 5 different creators that we spend $1 a month on, but mm-hmm. as we're able to grow, we can up our donations.
Absolutely.
And then also up the amount of creators we also support.
So let's get into our first block,
second block, actually.
Oh, damn it. It's our second. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well,
we did listener feedback. Now we're on our second block, which usually has a permit block, but we renamed it this week.
We're very cleverly. And I say that because I named it.
Yeah.
Doomsday prepping and pre-dawn door knocking. It's actually not what I named it, but that was the idea. And then Sarah was like, I want to make this better. So that was actually Sarah, but I came up with the concept.
I love how you were like, this was all me. And then like buried the lead. You're like, actually... It was a little bit of it was your idea. It's true.
It's true.
I just do the refining.
That's true. You also buried the lead on you getting a medical marijuana card. So I feel like we're pretty
even. There's a lot of burying the leads here. First we're going to talk about Paul Manafort.
Yes.
And just FYI, when we say pre-dawn door knocking, it refers to them knocking on his bedroom door. So I believe the FBI agents just came into his house.
Which...
like, unannounced.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, so they knocked on the bedroom door because it was pre-dawns, apparently. So let's get into the story.
Okay.
So just when you thought all was fairly quiet on the Manafort front.
Please.
All quiet on the Manafort front. That is our episode title.
Yes.
The Washington Post reported that FBI agents raided his home on July 26th, and they did so using a search warrant to seize documents and other materials.
Right, and July 26th...
Oh yeah, what's the significance of July 26th, Devin?
...is important because it is the day after he met voluntarily with the staff with the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Yeah.
So in that meeting, Manafort answered questions and provided investigators with notes from that June 2016 meeting between Don Jr. and Russians claiming to have... damaging information.
On Clinton. And which Manafort and Kushner also attended.
So, but Trump also called for the acting FBI director's firing hours after the FBI agents raided Paul Manafort's home.
Yeah, so also on July 26th was, like Devin said, Trump calling for the firing of McCabe, essentially.
Right.
So it's like, coincidence? Or because there were like FBI agents raiding his home, and then Trump was tweeting about the acting FBI director.
Yeah, yeah.
Surely it's just a coincidence.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah. So Manafort had been voluntarily turning over records to investigators, but the search warrant, according to this Washington Post story, indicates that they may have argued to a federal judge that they had reason to believe Manafort could not be trusted to turn over all records in response to a grand jury subpoena. So we talked about the grand jury subpoenas in our last episode.
I think so.
I can't remember if it was last week. Or I have such a hard time speaking of timelines. I'm like, when did that happen?
I know.
It both feels like yesterday and 1,000 years ago.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. We were saying, like,
we talked about it recently. Is the point. Yeah, so Senator Richard Blumenthal, he expanded upon this point on Twitter, actually, saying, quote, "Predawn raid on Manafort's house is stunning. It's typical of serious criminal investigations dealing with uncooperative or untrusted targets. Federal judge signing warrant would demand persuasive evidence of probable cause that a serious crime had been committed. This kind of raid in the early morning hours with no advance notice shows astonishing and alarming distrust for Trump's former campaign chairman. The raid decimates Manafort's claims of cooperation with law enforcement. It reflects evidence connecting Manafort to criminal wrongdoing."
Ooh, I know. Manafort's in trouble. No, but seriously, I mean, executing a warrant like that, it's
pretty significant.
It's pretty significant. And it means that they didn't trust him to turn over all the documents that he said he was going to turn over.
Yeah.
And they had to go find them. And then kind of Harvard law professor Lawrence Tribe said on Twitter, quote, "Dawn FBI raids targeting suspects who likely took the fifth represent the first judicial finding of probable cause in the Putin-Trump inquiry."
So what it sounds like Lawrence Tribe is saying is that now we're getting closer to potential evidence of actual coordination or collusion or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the real money is in the, and by money I mean metaphorical money, is in these physical documents, is in this paper trail.
Yeah.
So them seizing documents, it really indicates that that's what they're looking for.
And that they don't trust
him to turn
over things voluntarily.
Right.
The significance of these records, though, is unclear.
Right.
So, like, let's...
We don't know.
Let's couch this a little bit. However, the New York Times also reported on this story, and they said that tax documents and foreign banking records were collected at this raid. So that indicates sort of an increasingly broadening scope of Mueller's probe. And also, like we talked about in the last podcast, there's a sense among investigators that following the money might lead to more sort of fruitful findings.
Exactly.
Because collusion can be pretty hard to prove.
Right. I mean, because it's about, like I said last time, a thinky crime. It's like about intent and sort of the relationships, but money crimes are about paper.
It's not like there can't be like receipts on collusion.
Of course, I mean, like, it's just a lot harder to prove.
There's literally an email. I mean, like, again, I don't understand.
I always forget,
There's an email that was sent to fucking Don Jr. about, it. Literally the subject was like Russia, Clinton, like that shit. And like, he's like saying he loves getting Clinton dirt. I mean, like, I don't know how much more obvious that could
later
be.
In the summer.
Later in the summer. He loves it, especially later in the summer.
But they also only talked about adoptions, Sarah.
Right.
So,
right.
Come on.
Oh my gosh. So apparently Manafort's allies are worried that Mueller might be building a case against him unrelated to the 2016 campaign, sort of in the hopes that Manafort might cut a lesser deal in exchange for information about, you know, relevant dickwads in Trump circle. So, like, basically, like, you know, implicating someone else.
Right.
Like, oh, if they find a different case that could be incriminating, that might compel him to speak a little more truth on what the fuck happened in the campaign.
Mueller's a smart cookie.
And I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but the National Enquirer, which has a very cozy relationship with Trump, and they were just one of just a few outlets to endorse him in the campaign, they tweeted out, quote, "Donald Trump advisor Paul Manafort caught up in sick sex scandal."
Which is such a weird, like...
I know. But it's like, is that Trump trying to, like, intimidate and or smear Manafort? Because he's, like, worried that he's going to get implicated in the end?
I mean, if he is, using the National Enquirer is sort of a weird way to do it.
But he's done that before.
I know.
Like, this is...
But this isn't, like, a... This isn't, like, a I had an affair with Donald Trump thing. This is a I colluded with Russia thing.
That's not what they were tweeting, though.
No, I understand. But I'm saying the way he's used National Enquirer in the past was to get rid of, like, women that saying that they had an affair with him or these sort of, like...
But he's trying to distract, obviously.
Obviously trying to distract. But, I mean, I don't know that the National Enquirer can help him when it comes to Trump-Russia.
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, he's using every available option in his media arsenal.
That is true.
That's for sure. So, anyway, I'm sure we will learn a lot more about this show.
Know everything at some point.
And Paul Manafort. Okay, so let's move on, Devin,
yes,
to doomsday prepping.
Doomsday prepping.
So what the fuck is going on with Trump in North Korea?
Oh, God. So much. And we were just talking about this, how someone said the most annoying part of all of this is that doomsday preppers are going to turn out to be right. And that is very frustrating to me.
Yeah, someone tweeted that, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
Shit.
So true.
It is.
I need to start stocking up on, like, canned foods immediately.
Absolutely. Well, okay, so first let's do a little context for North Korea. In the past couple of months, North Korea has launched several ICBMs, which are intercontinental ballistic missiles, in hopes of perfecting one that could ultimately reach the United States. The tests have been mostly failures, though the most recent tests were reported to be successes.
Right.
And if that doesn't scare you right there, which it should, U.S. analysts are now reporting that North Korea has miniaturized its nuclear warhead so that they could be placed on the ICBMs.
So basically, that's like one of the important components of building a successful missile.
Right, exactly. You need to get the ICBM. You need to miniaturize the nuke. You need to have certain guidance systems. Mm-hmm. So they're just basically making progress. So,
and I think they're making more progress
than anyone thought.
They're ahead of sort of what people had
Estimated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was reported in a confidential assessment done by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and, quote, comes on the heels of another intelligence assessment that sharply raises the official estimate for up to 60 nuclear weapons controlled by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Some independent experts think the number is much smaller. So there's not really consensus on what's going on exactly. There's conflicting reports even within the intelligence agencies.
Well, I think that's almost by design of North Korea, because they are intentionally secretive.
Exactly.
And it's hard to really know.
Yeah, and they're intentionally putting out some information, like contradicting information, so we don't really know. Like we were talking about earlier, they're kind of on ahead of schedule of these components.
Yeah.
And North Korea has said that it will not give up its nuclear program, even in the face of harsh new sanctions.
Yeah.
So,
and then just also note about the miniaturization of the nuclear warhead and also how many nukes they have.
Right.
So those assessments are controversial and neither formally represents the consensus view of the U.S. intelligence
conflicting
community.
Reports.
Well, it's just that not every intelligence, you know, agency necessarily agrees with
right.
it. So, but it doesn't mean it's any less true. It's just that there isn't consensus.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's something I think that's important. In addition to the U.S. assessment, Japan's government also released a white paper on North Korea's nuclear program. And what did that say, Devin?
It said, quote, it's conceivable that North Korea's nuclear weapons program has already considerably advanced, and it is possible that North Korea has already achieved the miniaturization of nuclear weapons into warheads and has acquired nuclear warheads. So they're a little more like fire and brimstone in their white paper, where they're like, no, this has definitely happened.
Mm.
They have the nuclear warhead. They've miniaturized it successfully.
And I think Rachel Maddow said when she was reporting on this was that there was some reports like in the recent past sort of coming to similar conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
But then they ended up kind of getting batted down, like this is wrong. And she said, like, even other countries like Japan, like, they might have said, yeah, that's wrong. But they're not coming out and saying that this is wrong. In fact, they're saying that it's conceivable that this is happening.
Right, exactly. And that... I mean, that's really terrifying.
it's pretty terrifying.
So obviously in response to this, you know, rapidly expanding missile and nuclear program, Trump gave a very reasonable, calm, and nuanced warning.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's what I think. Those are the adjectives I think of when I think of Trump.
Yeah, no, fuck that. He said that North Korea would be met with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen, to which I say somebody is up to date on his Game of Thrones episodes.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I mean, that sounds like, you know what? it sounds like fiction. It sounds like fiction.
It's exactly how I thought he would probably react, but it still is shocking. I'm like, you are allegedly the leader of the free world.
Right.
Like, what the fuck
are you doing?
I mean, I know it's not surprising. This is who he is, but it's like, you're going to get us all killed.
Yes.
You asshole.
You asshole. So experts say that this sort of response is dangerous, obviously, but Kim Jong-un could see it as a direct threat and respond with a preemptive attack. Mm-hmm. In fact, North Korea already reacted to this rhetoric by saying that it is, quote, carefully examining a strike against Guam, and said in a later statement that North Korea would take preemptive action at signs of provocation.
And this, for me, is especially eerie, that it's happening around the 72nd anniversaries of the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah.
There's a really fascinating book called Almighty that the author, he tweeted out an excerpt of it, and the descriptions of what people went through when the bombs were dropped is haunting.
Yeah.
It's so, so chilling. And, like, you know, I know that the mayor of Nagasaki has called on world leaders to give up nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's still very much in their, on their mind, obviously.
Yeah. It's really scary.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also worth noting that this sort of over-the-top rhetoric is really what we in the world have come to expect from leaders like Kim Jong-un,
mm-hmm.
But not from the leader of the U.S.
Yeah.
Even North Korea said that they couldn't negotiate with Trump and that he was, quote, bereft of reason.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm finding myself agreeing with North Korea.
So, like, we should all look at our life and look at our choices and see how we got here.
Mm-hmm. Trump is also seen around the world as all talk and no action,
mm-hmm.
which is how, you know, the president of the United States should... Like, that's definitely not how they should be viewed by anyone, much less our adversaries.
Right.
And Elon Goldenberg, who's the senior Middle East security director for the Center for New American Security, had a really incisive thread about this. So, quote, danger with Trump and nukes isn't just the crazy talk, the crazy tough talk, but the absolute lack of credibility that comes with it. When he first came into office, many of our partners and adversaries were nervous, but now they think he's a joke. Whether it be threatening North Korea with a carrier that wasn't there, or threatening China for not doing much more to rein in North Korea, it is clear the man is all talk, no action. Not to mention his incompetence on one signature issue after another. The wall, the Muslim ban, Obamacare, and of course he is a serial liar. So does Kim Jong-un, or anyone for that matter, take him seriously when he threatens war? Doubtful, and that is incredibly dangerous because it will cause our adversaries to push the envelope and test him when they do that. And when they do that, it's precisely the type of situation where miscalculation could actually lead to genuine conflict, especially if it's coupled with over-the-top belligerent rhetoric and a policy process that sometimes emanates from his Twitter account. So essentially what that thread is saying is, okay, no one wants, like, us to get into this, like, nuclear standoff with North Korea or anyone. But it's also bad for Trump to talk a big game and have no follow through, because then for everything, no one's going to take our leadership seriously, which they already really don't.
Well, and this is
sort of, then they'll push the envelope with us.
I mean, I know that we've talked about comparing Trump to children and toddlers, but it's sort of like when a toddler throws a temper tantrum, if you give an inch, then they're going to assume that you'll always give an inch.
And then they're going to try to take a mile.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and what is possibly worse about all of this, but it's really hard to tell these days, is that Trump's statement was ad-libbed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not to put too fine a point on it.
The fire and fury.
The fire and fury statement was ad-libbed.
Mm-hmm.
There was no messaging around that. So,
and there's definitely no prep around it.
Exactly. So not to put too fine a point on it, but, you know, Obama's version of ad-libbing was singing Amazing Grace at a funeral for a murdered pastor in the Charleston church shooting.
Yeah.
So, you know, Democrats and Republicans are totally the same.
They're the same, and there's no difference between Trump and Clinton. I can't see.
Not even a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was confirmed. So three White House officials told the Daily Beast that Trump's threats against North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un, were off the cuff.
Yeah. And I don't, like, it's almost like Trump has no experience, like, no well of experience from which he can draw, like, actual diplomacy.
Wait, is the presidency an entry-level job?
Oh, my God.
because not having any experience is totally fine.
I'm just like, we literally could have had the smartest woman who was a Secretary of State and one of our best ones. And like, oh my God.
I know.
I'm sorry. Like, No. I'm always going to bring that up. I'm never going to get over that.
Nope.
Ever. But okay, we should also have a lot of perspective here, yes. I think. And I think we are guilty of doing this. Like, we did it throughout this segment. South Korea, you know, they're like, hi, welcome to our world, you American assholes.
Yeah, totally.
So NPR's Elise Hu is based in Seoul, and she told CNN, quote, South Korea is a country that's lived under the existential threat of North Korea for decades. So the new ICBM capabilities and the war of words that Americans are getting tense about doesn't translate over here in the same way. On Korean Twitter today, the trending topic was the possibility of an extra week of summer break.
Yeah.
So, like, some perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think, you know, we haven't gotten into the Melissa McEwen interview yet at this point in the show. We've already talked to her.
Right.
But she talked about how there's sort of this self-centeredness from Americans.
About this type of war.
About, nuclear war. When, you know, we have intervened in a lot of places, mm-hmm. and, you know, killed people and displaced people, and, like, we need to have some perspective.
And I think a big part of we, the country as a whole, don't really care about these wars that aren't nuclear, you know, what Melissa McEwen would be talking about, is that, you know, there's this economic theory of war called guns versus butter. Mm-hmm. So if a government is spending all their money on guns, there's not enough money for butter.
Right.
And when people don't have butter, they get pissy.
Mm-hmm.
And so because the United States has sort of created this military complex where we pay for both guns and butter.
Yeah, even though, like, you can arguably say income inequality is among the worst it's ever been.
Right.
In general, you're saying there's still, quote-unquote, money for butter.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's at least enough money for butter where we're not looking at how much we're spending on guns. In fact, most people want us to spend more on guns because there's no consequence for the butter, whatever butter may be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, welfare programs, education.
And often, when, like we've seen with Trump's budget, they're slashing a lot of those programs,
right.
and trying to up the spending on military spending.
Even more.
Which, there are people like us who do care about it.
Right.
But you're saying the country as a whole, the larger, like, conscientiousness.
Right.
It doesn't sort of affect the country en masse.
Right, in a large scale, which is part of the reason why, you know, there's no downside to keep these wars going on forever. Politically, war looks great on a resume.
Well, and that's the frustrating thing. Whenever Trump was talking about, like, possibly going to war,
right.
that's when pundits were starting to say, oh, he sounds presidential.
Exactly.
His approval ratings were starting to go up.
Right.
Like, and it's so frustrating because you're like, that's not how it should be.
Exactly. And so the sort of... Now, with a possibility of nuclear war and miniaturization and missiles that could actually hit us, people are like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah, all of a sudden, we're like, oh, shit.
Oh, shit, there's consequences. Mm-hmm. But there's been consequences.
We might be affected.
Exactly.
Whereas people in other countries have been so significantly affected
exactly.
by our own sort of intervention in militarization and war.
Exactly. So I think it's just important to remember that outside of it just, you know, battle doesn't come to our shores, there's also no, like, economic downside for us as Americans. Overall.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's
That's
a lot.
Speaking in general terms.
Very general, like, talking about, like, macro-level budget
sure.
sort of stuff. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, we're really excited to welcome our guests today. Melissa McEwen is a freelance writer and founder of the progressive feminist blog Shakesville. According to the site's FAQ, they write about domestic politics, foreign policy, high culture, pop culture, books, film, telly, food, the patriarchy, oppression, repression, religion, philosophy, parenting, not parenting, marriage, pets, why women's trousers have so many buttons, and anything else that they feel like discussing. Although Donald Trump and his gang of miscreants is taking up exorbitant amounts of time of their time these days, which, hard agree.
We agree.
We're there with you. So we're thrilled to get to speak with you today. Welcome to Hell Bent, Melissa.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. There is so much to talk about.
There is.
I mean, it's... Where do you even start? But really, what we really wanted to talk to you about is Mike Pence. We refer to him as Mike motherfucking Pence because mm-hmm. he calls his wife mother.
Which creeps me the hell out.
That's a whole thing. And then, but first, before we get into Mike Pence, I think we wanted to talk to you about healthcare because you had a great mm-hmm. blog about it and it's sort of been a hot button topic. So we wanted to get your thoughts on the Politico story that stated that Medicare for All is fast becoming a Democratic Party quote unquote litmus test. This is, of course, on the heels of the DCCC saying abortion essentially wouldn't be a litmus test, and Bernie Sanders asserting in April that we shouldn't, quote, exclude people who disagree with us on one issue. So what concerns do you have about these stories in tandem?
Well, so it's interesting because Bernie said that we shouldn't exclude people who disagree with us on one issue, specifically regarding abortion. That yeah. was the one issue to which he was referring.
Right.
And I think we're in agreement here that abortion is healthcare. They're not mutually exclusive issues. And control over reproduction is a key economic issue for women and others who can get pregnant. So the fact that Bernie has positioned himself as a leader on progressive economic issues but doesn't understand or maybe just doesn't care that abortion access is a critical economic issue and that abortion is healthcare concerns me yeah. significantly. And one of my biggest concerns with Bernie all throughout the primary and to this day is that he has lots of big ideas but provides very few details on how he will get his policies enacted. So this push to make single payer litmus test is a perfect example because of the Hyde Amendment.
Right, right.
So for people who don't know what the Hyde Amendment is, that's since 1976, Congress has voted every year to renew this this amendment known as the Hyde Amendment, named after Henry Hyde, which prevents federal dollars from being used to fund abortion. And so if this retrograde Republican Congress that we have now, who is busy trying to eradicate Obamacare altogether, somehow magically agreed to pass single payer, which mm-hmm. seems unlikely, but if that happened, every single pregnant person in the country would have to pay for abortion out of her or his or their own pocket if mm-hmm. they wanted to terminate that pregnancy, because there's a law in place preventing the federal government from funding the procedure.
Right.
So that's not an incidental issue. That's a central economic issue for women, and Bernie doesn't seem to have given any thought to it. And also how Hyde stands as a dangerous precedent for limiting payments on specific medical procedures. You know, think of the consequences that could have for anyone with a transgressive body, mm-hmm. you know, trans people, fat people, disabled people, without a plan to ensure a conservative government couldn't replicate Hyde right. against multiple populations. Single payer could actually further entrench existing devastating health disparities.
Yeah.
So.
So, like, the TLDR is, it sounds like a great idea in theory, but there's so many complexities that need to be crucially examined. And then a plan of implementation to make sure that everyone is covered for the essential care that they need.
Yeah, that really bothers me, not having a plan. I also find it interesting right. that Bernie says that we don't have to, we can disagree on one issue, but people who disagree with him on single payer are somehow, like, not progressive.
Right.
So you can be progressive and disagree on abortion, but you can't be progressive and disagree about single payer.
But also abortion is healthcare. So right. it's kind of like, it's, right. so he's like, it doesn't jive.
Yeah, exactly. There's no like.
Yeah. I think.
But it's coded as women's healthcare. Right, exactly. So therefore right.
it's like a side.
It's secondary.
Side right. issue, yeah. quote unquote. Yeah. So I think this is a topic we're going to be constantly referring back to. We've talked about it on the podcast a lot, but let's move into Mike Pence.
Yes.
First of all, what do you make of that New York Times story that ran recently on Pence's quote unquote shadow campaign to run for president in 2020 if there is an opening? Do you think it's just media fodder, or do you think there is really some serious behind the scenes work to prepare him to be commander in chief either before 2020 or in 2020?
Oh, he's preparing.
Yeah.
He's absolutely preparing. I mean, listen, Mike Pence is a terrible person with abundant flaws, but one of them is not failing to prepare to seize more power for himself.
Right.
This is a guy who is about to lose re-election as governor of Indiana, and now he's the proverbial heartbeat away from the presidency. Wow. And that doesn't happen if you're not prepared.
That's true. You're saying before he was picked as a running mate? he was up for re-election and was losing that race.
Yes, and he would have lost.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
And
Melissa... Yeah, I mean, in Indiana, I mean, there were just signs everywhere on lawns that just were, you know, anti-Pence, get rid of Pence, fire Mike Pence, don't elect, re-elect Pence, like, Pence is the worst. he was not popular. No, he would have lost.
So he's really, truly a white man failing upward.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Like, if you look that up in the dictionary, it just is a picture of Mike Pence.
It's Mike
Pence. The whitest, even his hair is white.
It's true, that's true. He's, like, kind of, like, monotone a little bit. So, this is sort of an intentionally broad question, so feel free to take whatever angle or angles you want, but I think everyone is sort of wondering, even though Mike Pence is a shitty person, would he be an improvement on Donald Trump as the president, and why or why not?
No, he wouldn't be. And I get a lot of pushback on that every time I say it. But the thing about Pence is that he's just as vile as Trump, but he's way more disciplined.
Right, right.
So you know how people say, oh, at least Trump is a bumbling incompetent, so very little of his agenda is getting enacted. Well, if that thought brings you relief, the specter of a Pence presidency should send a cold chill down your spine because he knows how to get shit done.
Right.
And I've also heard, you know, it's very common, I think, this talking point that at least Pence won't blow up the planet. Now, I do think he's far less likely to start a war with a tweet or because someone insulted his golf trousers or whatever. But, you know, his rhetoric at North Korea back in April was barely less incendiary than Trump's the past few days. When he was standing on the USS Ronald Reagan, he said, you know, flanked by people in military uniforms. And this is a direct quote. I wrote it down so I could read it to you. Those who would challenge our resolve or our readiness should know we will defeat any attack and meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective American response.
I read that and it terrified me.
I actually don't think I read that.
I saw that.
And that's the thing. It kind of was like, oh, you know, whatever. It's no big deal. It's just the vice president. But I mean, that if you read that Trump said that this week, it seems right in line with everything else he's saying. So it is probably true that Pence is less likely to start a nuclear war over some bullshit. And that's no small thing. I don't want to minimize that. Mm-hmm. But Pence is just as likely, and maybe even more so, to start another kind of war.
Right.
Mm. Right. Like, there's no reason to believe that Pence is any less likely to replicate the strategy that worked so well for Bush and cook up some garbage rationale for invading another country.
Which is sort of insidious, you know, like it doesn't seem ridiculous on the surface. More people can, you know, rationalize their agreeance with it.
Well, right. And I think the reason that we view Pence as a better alternative to Trump, even though I think we probably, most of us agree that he would start a war like Bush, is because what we assume about nuclear war is that it will result in retaliation that might actually come to our shores, right? Like within our borders.
Sure.
You know, in a way, most of us, unless we're members of the military or have family members serving, we've never had to really reckon with as a result of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars or any war in living memory outside of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think I don't want to see either kind of war happen with equal urgency. I think that we just find nuclear war worse somehow because, like I said, we figure that that will result in retaliation within our borders.
Right.
And not because we're worried about, for example, a million displaced Iraqis, hundreds of thousands of dead, you know? So that feels worse somehow because it's about us. It's a little bit of a self-centered kind of concern.
Absolutely.
That Pence would be better.
Yeah. Right. No, that's a really good point. So Mandy, one of our Patreon supporters, wants to know how you think the media, and particularly the more sort of center-left leaning media, would react to a Pence presidency should Trump be removed or resign. So essentially, would they fawn over him and give him sort of a free pass on his appalling record and sort of, you know, what he might want to do, given that he presents as a more quote unquote stable figure than the dumpster fire that is Trump?
Yeah, I think he would get a pass. And I think we are probably already seeing evidence of that. Like if you look at the Senate's repeated attempts to pass legislation to appeal to repeal Obamacare. Pence was at the dead center of that. Mm-hmm. He was whipping up votes. He was prepared to cast the tie-breaking vote. And if you remember the photo of him meeting with the all-dude Freedom Caucus during the House repeal, he tweeted that pic, not Trump, right?
Yeah.
Not Trump. Like, Pence sort of proudly tweeted, like, look at all of us dudes, like, writing healthcare. And yet, when the whole thing fell apart, I mean the Senate part now, not the House part, there's lots of blame to go around, but you barely heard Pence's name.
That's right. a really good point.
Well, he skates by.
Well, I wonder, too, I feel like in a lot of these narratives, healthcare, this Russia investigation, Pence has very neatly removed himself from the narrative. And I feel like that kind of leads into our next question. You know, Gary, who's another Patreon contributor, had a great question. What policies, stances, and actions from his time as Indiana governor have flown below the national radar that should concern us? Because he has so effectively removed himself from these narratives, and a lot of people don't know much about him. So what are the things like that are really flags?
Right. And part of the reason no one really knows about him is because the national media doesn't really care about him and doesn't talk to anyone who covered him in Indiana, which is a problem because he has a good chance of being our next president. And I think to answer Gary's question, which is a really good question, the answer has to start with Glenda Ritz. And Glenda Ritz, if you've never heard her name, it's unfortunate that you haven't, but mm-hmm. she was a Democrat who was elected in 2012 to be Indiana's superintendent of public instruction. So think of her as like the education secretary of the state. And she was a huge underdog, but she defeated the incumbent because a majority of Hoosiers, both progressive and conservative and in between, supported her willingness to challenge Republican proposals that would destroy public education in Indiana. The former governor, Mitch Daniels, is a big proponent of privatization, which, you know, has a whole
history. Whole other interview on
one. Exactly. So anyway, Ritz was the first Democrat to serve as superintendent in 40 years. Wow. Okay, that's a long time.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
And Pence was elected during that same election, right? So this is the election where he became governor. Glenda Ritz was elected. And one of his first acts, that's not an exaggeration, one of his first acts as governor was to remove Ritz from the Union-Centered Educational Employment Relations Board. So the Republican-controlled House Education Committee proposed a bill to strip the superintendent's position as chair of the State Board of Education.
Wow.
And that bill allowed Mike Pence to have 10 appointees to the 11-member board.
What?
And allowed them to elect their own chair.
Whoa.
So in other words, as soon as a Democrat was elected to an influential state position with 53% of the vote, which is higher than Pence got in the same election,
right,
the Republican governor and legislature set to rendering her office utterly without power and empowering themselves to oust her.
Wow.
Just to prevent the reforms that she was elected to champion.
So what's happened to her now? Is she still in office? Like, what's the follow-up?
The follow-up is that there is no ability now for anyone, essentially, unless there is a Democratic governor in Indiana, to prevent Republican quote-unquote reform of education in Indiana.
Wow.
So as long as these bills stay in place, which they probably will for the foreseeable future, that's it. Like, the Republicans just have free reign. There's no one to stop them because they completely denuded the office.
Yeah. Wow. And that's like the insidious stuff,
right,
that you're kind of, that Devin has talked about, that you're like definitely have enumerated quite eloquently, is that Pence knows how to work around and within the system to get to enact his agenda.
Right.
So he has this institutional knowledge to undercut political opponents and to do these like extreme things. And just remind our listeners, Melissa, how long had you lived in Indiana? Like, you are very closely acquainted with these politics and the policies of Mike Pence because you lived there for so long, correct?
Right. Well, I was born in Indiana.
Right.
So yeah, I lived there The first 18 years of my life, I lived in Illinois, just across the border in Chicago. For the next 10 years. And then I moved back to Indiana. Yeah. So I've lived there most of my life.
Yeah. Well, and sort of on that track, you recently wrote in regards to Pence, quote, "That's how Mike Pence does business. A complete lack of transparency, contempt for the law, and zero accountability." And so we've kind of talked about how this has played out through his political career and in the present day, but kind of, you know, can you kind of talk about how that is manifesting itself presently?
Yeah, well, let me first start by talking about some of the things he did as governor, because they're going to sound very familiar,
okay,
right,
yeah,
to what's happening in the Trump administration.
Yes.
So while he was governor, he tried to set up a state-run media outlet.
What?
What?
He signed Indiana's religious freedom bill, mm-hmm, quote unquote, religious freedom bill, into law in a private ceremony away from criticism or dissent.
Wow.
Not to mention in contravention of the will of the majority of Hoosiers.
Wow.
The majority of Hoosiers were against it. He signed it anyway.
Yeah.
This again will sound familiar. He tried to block Syrian refugees from settling in Indiana.
Wow.
He pursued pointless investigations of Planned Parenthood. Let's put it this way. Many of the things you're seeing going on in the Trump administration are things that were first tested in Indiana, which I refer to as the conservative legislation lab.
Yeah.
And that has never been more true than with Pence running policy,
yeah,
for the Trump White House.
Wow.
I mean, what he did as governor looks like what's happening now. I mean, and the most important thing to understand about Mike Pence is that it's not just his policies, which are hot garbage, which they are, but that he doggedly pursues enactment of those policies by any means necessary.
Right.
He will gleefully undermine our democratic systems and norms to achieve turning his state or his entire country into the authoritarian theocracy of his dreams and our night terrors.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I've read a lot of your writing. Obviously, I love your work, and I have been swayed by your writing. Like, oh yeah, maybe Mike Pence is a little bit more, you know, terrifying. But I'm like, but then still all these things. I would say in the span of this conversation, you have completely convinced me that Mike Pence is absolutely more horrifying than Donald Trump.
He's at least as horrifying. Like, I don't
right.
know if I don't even know if I can make the case that he's
more.
Because
yeah.
even though, yes, he's more disciplined, you know, there's obviously, like, Trump has, like, some, you know, shit
right.
going on that
sure.
is, like, beyond, like, Mike Pence wouldn't engage in nepotism, let's say. You know, there's,
gotcha.
There's right. back and forth, but he's at least as bad.
Right.
Like, anyone who thinks, like, oh, it's going to be such a relief if we get Pence. No.
Well, and no. I do not be comforted in Pence.
And I think part of the reason Pence is so scary, to me at least, is he has this...
He's so polished.
Yeah, he has this veneer of sort of respectability
mm-hmm.
that Trump
mm-hmm.
definitely lacks.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of has this look and this sort of like tone
mm-hmm.
that he's trustworthy
mm-hmm.
and that makes people more, you know, comfortable with, like, when he says something very, very nicely,
mm-hmm.
you know, like
it's
I would like
still as chilling.
It still is chilling, but in a nicer package.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It makes, I think the reason that that's scary is because it makes for less media scrutiny.
Right. It's less obvious.
Yeah.
Like, Trump
yeah.
is so over the top.
It is.
Okay. So, moving on to sort of Trump-Russia, we've sort of talked about how Mike Pence has sort of been able to fly below the radar in a lot of ways. So knowing what you know about Mike Pence, plus all the reporting about him likely lying about how much he knew about Flynn's conflicts of interest, plus the fact that Manafort basically handpicked him to be vice president, which if you hellions don't know, essentially when Manafort was part of Trump's campaign or the head of the campaign, he tricked Trump into thinking like the flight out of somewhere was delayed, and then had him meet with Mike Pence because Trump was going to pick Chris Christie as VP, but then Manafort tricked Trump into meeting with Pence and then inevitably picking him. So that's just, if you don't know, that's what happened. So given all that, given what we know about Mike Pence and what he knew about Flynn and how he was selected as VP, how entangled do you think he is with the Trump campaign possibly colluding with Russia?
Oh, he's up to his neck. Absolutely up to his neck. I mean, and listen, there is no more compelling evidence of that to me than the fact that he pulled the same play out of his shitty playbook to defend and deflect on Mike Flynn and what he knew about Mike Flynn. So here's another thing from when he was governor in Indiana. In the very same way that he claimed to have learned about Flynn's shit in the media. Do you remember how he was like, oh, I didn't know until I saw it? Okay.
Yeah.
he claimed, again, while he was governor, that he learned from the press about that state-run and taxpayer-funded news outlet that I mentioned earlier.
No.
What?
So that whole... Yeah, so he was trying to set up a propaganda outlet in Indiana and claimed he didn't know about it. He said, I frankly learned about the memo from press reports late Monday. Now, he said that despite the fact that two employees had already been hired, that a governance board of communications directors had been established, that a draft story had already been circulated, and that he himself had tweeted about it.
No. Yeah.
So this, I learned about it from the press, chestnut, is like his go-to move to dissociate himself from troubling stories that go public via leaks. Like, he feigns ignorance because, for him, it's preferable to look like he's out of the loop than intractably corrupt.
So why do you think people believe him?
I do not know. I mean, he is a snake.
Yeah.
Because he's snake. Polished, I think.
Yeah, that veneer polished. Of respectability. The veneer.
Wow, this has been fascinating.
And also terrifying.
And
so,
also terrifying. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Thank you, but I might not sleep for the next 5 or 6 days.
Yeah.
Well, or years.
Depending
on how things turn out. Yeah.
Okay, so we like to close off our interview
on
a more uplifting note, even though we do appreciate your knowledge on such dark topics. So, you know, as the last question for our guests, we like to ask them to share a gratitude check. So that's something that we do every episode to sort of take stock of the good things that are happening amidst, like we said, such dark times. So what are you grateful for right now? And it could be anything little or small, personal, political, like really anything.
Netflix.
Netflix. Always grateful for Netflix. Yeah. I would say right now, though, I want to say that being here talking to you is something that I'm grateful for. And I keep saying this over and over, but in an age of both official and just widespread gaslighting.
Yes.
Building community with people who validate what we all know to be true, what happened during the election and what's happening still and why is incredibly important to me. And so I'm really grateful for anyone who values that too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love that too.
Yeah.
And I have to say, so Melissa and I have, I will just say we have the best DMs. Like I just love, I love direct messaging with Melissa because I'm like, this chick gets it. Mm-hmm. Like I'm so grateful for your writing.
Yeah.
Because it's so clear and concise and nuanced. And, you know, a lot of people just sort of on that vein, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, we shouldn't relitigate 2016. Everyone needs to move on. And like, yeah, to a certain extent, that's true. But so many of the narratives that persist inform how Democrats and how people on the left and how our government is moving forward.
Right.
So if we don't get that right, it's just like, then we're learning all the wrong lessons.
Well, and in this age where Mike Pence can make a bald-faced lie on national television, and that's not really questioned, I think we need an accurate sort of documentation of what's actually going on.
Yeah.
So that is...
That's a great gratitude check.
Yeah. I'm also very grateful for the community building aspect. I say it all the time, but like this podcast in this community is the best thing I've ever done with my time.
Women Democrats.
Together.
Yeah. It's a really, really great gratitude check. Okay, so thank you to Melissa McEwen for joining us on Hellbent today. I mean, it was such a fascinating conversation.
Also terrifying.
I think I'm going to go back and listen to it a couple times because you dropped so much important knowledge. So you can follow Melissa on Twitter at ShakesTweets. That's ShakesTweets. And then you can also read and support her work at Shakesville.com. So thank you, Melissa. Thanks for joining us
today. It was great to have you on.
Well, thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you.
All right, Devin. Well, that was a really awesome interview with Melissa McEwen.
I loved it.
Both terrifying, informative, and uplifting at the end. I loved her gratitude check.
I did too. That was so sweet. Although I will say, I was not kidding. I will not be sleeping for the foreseeable future.
For a lot of reasons.
For a lot of reasons.
Okay, so let's get into our gratitude checks.
Yes.
So what are you grateful for today?
So the first thing I'm grateful for is Maggie Hassan. Mm-hmm. So she is the senator for New Hampshire, mm-hmm. one of them. And there's a beautiful profile interview of her in Elle.
Yeah.
And reading it just made my day. I didn't know much about Hassan besides the fact that she won her Senate seat by like an incredibly thin margin.
Yeah, it was like 1,000 votes. Yeah,
it was something ridiculous.
And there was hundreds of thousands of ballots cast. So never believe that every vote doesn't count.
Exactly. So, and just, I didn't know anything about her. So, like, mm-hmm. learning about her and her political career is great. So, she actually got into politics because her oldest son has severe physical disabilities. And so, it turned her into a passionate advocate for healthcare.
Yeah.
And she started lobbying, like, her state and local representatives. And that's kind of how she, like, broke slowly into being a politician.
Wow.
And I really love this quote kind of about Americans with Disabilities Act and sort of healthcare right now. She said, quote, "Adapt advocacy is reminding people that we're talking about civil rights of all Americans here. If you don't have access to healthcare and you aren't healthy, you can't reach your full potential and contribute at the level that we should all expect of each other as American citizens."
Yeah, that's really well said.
I thought that was really beautiful because we often decouple healthcare and civil rights, but really they are the same issue.
Again, social issues, our economic issues, our healthcare issues, they're all intertwined.
They
Don't
are.
Let any fucking white male Democrat tell you otherwise.
Exactly, exactly. Or in the words of Donald Trump, who knew healthcare was so complicated?
Literally everyone.
Literally fucking everyone.
And especially Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. And she also talked about how women in politics and representation really matters, which was really great. She shared a story about her male colleague who had young daughters, mm-hmm. and he asked, so her colleague asked his daughters if he should run for governor, and they said no. And so he asked why, and they said, well, you can't because you're not a girl.
Oh, and they were thinking of her?
Yeah, like just apparently New Hampshire's leadership and politics are like very well represented with women.
Okay.
So they were like, and I guess they only knew, because she was governor at the time, and they only knew a governor of the state as a woman.
Oh.
So she said, you can't because you're not a girl.
That broke me.
I know.
I mean, could you imagine?
I know. It's so beautiful. So, and she, there was another great quote, and she said, "The fact is, role models matter. It really matters to people to see women in leadership, and that's one of the ways that we can break through some of the barriers that still exist, just simply by being there." It was so good.
I love that.
I love it. And so basically, it just, the whole thing like made my heart grow 3 sizes.
Yes.
And so run, show up, be there. Like, you are qualified.
Or just support other women
running. Or just support other women running.
Lord knows I've talked too much shit on this podcast and on twitter.com to run.
Right.
But I will be there and I will cheerlead other hellions and other women.
Exactly.
Especially progressive women who want to run.
Exactly.
So I love that.
It was so beautiful. So definitely worth a read. Just such a cool woman.
Yeah. And we'll link to it again in our show notes.
Yes. So the second thing that I'm grateful for is non-political, which...
Whoa. It's been a while.
I know.
I feel like since a non-political
it
one.
It really has. Uh-huh. But this one was really cool. The New York Times did this really cool data visualization mm-hmm. with these map graphs that show how popular artists are in different regions.
Oh, interesting.
So the maps were their relative popularity, mm-hmm. And it just showed, and they did artists like Rihanna, Beyonce, mm-hmm. like, you know, all these different
people.
They did 50 of them, Justin Bieber, and showed, that one was really interesting, and then showed where they were the most popular in the country. And it was interesting to sort of see
regionally,
like who's popular where. And there were also a bunch of artists that I had never heard of that were extremely popular in the South or the Midwest or, you know, that I literally just hadn't heard of. So it was kind of interesting how like that sort of regional cultural difference. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I just thought it was cool.
And it was like a good nerd out sesh.
It was a good nerd out
sesh. We all know Devin loves a good nerd out sesh.
I do. I love a good like data visualization.
And
you know,
or D&D and or Star Trek sesh.
Slash, I'm wearing a BB-8 shirt today.
Oh,
so
I didn't even realize that. I was like, oh, that's a cool like white shirt with orange.
No,
like,
it's BB-8.
Drawing.
Yeah. So that was really cool. Also, they have 50 artists, and for all of them, for all the maps that they did, they have a YouTube video with like one of their songs or hit songs.
Oh, cool.
So as you're going through, I was like listening to, especially the artists I'd never heard before. And I was going through and listening to the music. So it was really fun and sort of a nice like
palate cleanser.
Palate cleanser, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. like like stress break, I guess. It was really nice.
I love that.
So New York Times actually does some really cool data visualization and on non-political things.
They had a really cool one that they adopted from research showing income inequality.
Yes.
Recently.
Yeah. So they do a really great job with
really impactful.
Really impactful. And then also fun things like this music thing, which is really fun.
Yeah.
So
love that.
Yeah, it was really great. So Sarah, what are you grateful for?
So I have two political things. Always. So the first thing I'm grateful for, and I have to give a shout out to one of our Hellion Sahar for pointing me to the story. I think she posted in the Facebook group and or Twitter about it. But the first thing I'm grateful for is a federal judge in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
So a judge, Sam Sparks.
Best name ever.
Great name.
Sorry, that's amazing.
So Sam Sparks has dismissed the lawsuit that Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed against Travis County after Governor Greg Abbott signed the so-called Sanctuary City Bill, SB4, into law. So for those who are not familiar with SB4, it follows one passed in Arizona that also tried to use local and state law enforcement to question the immigration status of residents. The Supreme Court gutted the Arizona law and a settlement removed a, quote, show me your papers provision requiring officers to investigate a person's immigration status if they had, quote unquote, reasonable suspicion to believe that the person was undocumented. And just, you know, in addition to this, in this SB4 law, uncooperative sheriff, police chief, constable of jail administrators could face Class A misdemeanor charges if they refuse to comply with it. So it also punishes law enforcement officers who do not follow the law.
That is some bull-ass shit right there.
It's really, really bad. Yeah, so basically the context here is on the same day that the governor did sign SB4 into law, Paxton, who is the attorney general, filed the lawsuit as a part of a preemptive move. So according to the suit that was filed on May 7th, Paxton's reasoning for taking legal action was, quote, to avoid a multiplicity of suits in various forms questioning the constitutionality of the law from the defendants, which include a host of public servants affiliated with Travis County, including Austin Mayor Steve Adler. So essentially what this attorney general wanted to do was to have a judge declare this law constitutional.
Right.
Like, before these other lawsuits could move forward. And the judge dismissed it and was like, fuck you.
That's not how any of this works.
Yeah. So it's a really, really good temporary victory.
Right.
But a separate case filed in federal court in San Antonio by the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and it's also backed by several large cities, including Houston. So this case is challenging the constitutionality of the law. So a judge has yet to rule whether to let the law go into effect September 1st.
Wow.
So there's still quite a bit hanging in the balance.
Absolutely.
In this case, but it's a good temporary victory. And I mean, this law is so, so heinous in every regard. So I'm going to be watching SB4 carefully
right.
and seeing what happens. And again, thank you to Sahara for pointing this particular story out to me. The second thing I'm grateful for are Iowa Democrats. So in a special election on Tuesday, the Democratic Party maintained control of an Iowa House district that Trump won by plus 22.
Jesus.
Yeah. So Democrat Phil Miller defeated Republican Travis Harris by plus 10.
Wow.
Jesus. Yeah, so it's interesting because the seat, it was vacated because the man who held it had died.
Okay.
And that was a Democrat. So, but the area had gone for Trump pretty overwhelmingly.
Right.
So that's why I think people are latching onto this story. So it's also interesting because the GOP candidate, so Travis Harris, ran an ad attacking Miller for a school board vote allowing transgender students to use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender. And that aggressive push backfired on him very spectacularly. I mean, it's unclear how much of a factor it was in Miller's win, but it clearly didn't work for Republicans to push hard against
right.
quote-unquote identity politics, which, again,
civil
is just
rights.
Fucking
civil rights.
Rights.
Like, fuck off.
And also, like, I mean, not to go on too much of a rant, but I have
a podcast
and a high horse. Like, let me tell you some shit. But if anyone, like, leans heavily on quote-unquote identity politics, it's fucking Republicans.
That's it always
all
is.
All they ever fucking talk about. And also, like, politics that cater to sort of the white male interests, the sort of people in power with the most power, that is identity politics too, you assholes. Like, it's just that is seen as quote-unquote the default.
Right.
That's why people don't
sort of associate, you know, what Trump did, for example, like stoking racism and right. sexism and overall bigotry. That is quite clearly identity politics, quote unquote.
Right. And it's interesting, and by interesting, I mean awful, that that did not backfire on Trump, but now it backfired against this guy. Mm-hmm. At least, and this mm-hmm. was a very heavily Trump area. So, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. It's hard to draw any conclusions, but...
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, if we're really going to get into this, I mean, Trump lost the popular vote exactly. by 3 million.
So clearly he
won
it did.
He won by the rules of the game.
Right.
But in terms of, like, if he won by, like, the how people, like, felt overall, right. I mean, he still got a shit ton of votes, which is disgusting.
Right.
But he lost.
Right. So, and so to flip the idiom, like, he won by letter of the law, but not spirit of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah.
Anyway, so back to the story on Iowa Democrats. Mm-hmm. So Jessica Post of the DLCC said, quote, DLCC is putting Republicans on notice. Tonight's victory is a testament to Democrats' strength in deep red districts. And then this was an interesting statistic courtesy of Daily Coast Elections. Quote, Democrats have outpaced Clinton and Obama in about 75% of races. In 2013, they outpaced Obama in just 16% of all races. So that's super interesting.
Yeah.
That makes me feel, again, like there's a little bit of a blue wave coming.
Yeah.
And there's plenty, you know, that can still happen. There's plenty to still be worried about, like voter suppression. But these are all good signs.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful Ooh. For this.
Absolutely. And also, this also goes to show margins matter.
And local politics is sexy.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get into our listener gratitude checks. So the first one is courtesy of Jessica. She said, quote, you probably heard that early Saturday morning, a cowardly terrorist threw a bomb into a mosque in Bloomington, Minnesota, a suburb just outside Minneapolis. Worshippers were gathered for morning prayers, but fortunately no one was injured. Last night, more than 1,000 Minnesotans of all faiths and backgrounds gathered outside the mosque to hear clergy and elected officials, including Senator Al Franken, express their sorrow and reinforce their belief in a community that supports love and diversity. Imams, rabbis, pastors, and priests all offered prayers. The members of Dar al-Farouk offered tea and water, and after the speeches, they served hundreds of delicious sambusas, savory pastries from the Somali food tradition. Many of Minnesotans' Muslims are of Somali descent, and State Rep. Ilhan Omar recently was elected as the nation's first Somali-American legislator. Our late Senator Paul Wellstone said, "We all do better when we all do better. I am proud to live in a community where people are willing to step forward when a neighbor is threatened." And that is really beautiful.
That is really beautiful.
Especially, you know, in contrast to the White House's initial lack of response,
right,
and then this bullshit sort of response saying that liberals have made this up.
Yeah,
again, we're gonna be talking about this more on Patreon, but thank you to Jessica for sharing that. That definitely is an awesome gratitude check.
It is. So the next one is Tam. Mm-hmm. Said a few things: a strong circle of friends who can be strong when I am not, HBO's Insecure being so fucking true to life, and a reminder that it's okay for Black women to flounder around while figuring it out. Rihanna.
Those are a great three gratitude check.
Love that.
Like, Rihanna, Evergreen. And also, I love Insecure.
I haven't seen it.
It's really, really good.
Okay.
It's a really great show.
Yeah.
She's so funny, and the writing is great. The characters are great. And yeah, it's just an awesome show.
Yeah, and also, strong group of friends. Like, get your girl gang.
Yes.
It's so good.
Bonobos.
Like, bonobo with the fuck up.
Yeah, bonobo with the fuck up.
Yeah.
Like,
love it.
Find your fellow bonobos.
Exactly.
And then Laura said, quote, someone put Post-its on the mirror of the women's bathroom where I work at Google. Quote, you are valued. Quote, you belong here. Quote, you deserve to be at Google. I was feeling pretty down about the whole situation, and that absolutely made my day.
That's good. That's
and
so good.
Yeah, we talked about this Google situation on the last podcast, and after we had spoken about it, the guy who ended up writing that like memo or manifesto got fired.
Boy,
like,
bye.
Like, get the fuck out of here. So yeah, I can't imagine what it's like, you know, to be a woman and or a minority at Google and feeling like, fuck. Like,
yeah, do they want me here?
Do they want me here? And so that's really great. And I'm glad that Laura was uplifted by her fellow women Googlers putting those Post-its on the mirror in the bathroom.
It's really sweet. And so our last one is from Beth. And she said, quote, my oldest son requesting to wear a shirt with a unicorn that says trample the patriarchy for the first day of school.
Yes.
We live in a very white bread Republican area, and he's going to get comments. comments. He doesn't care. He says it's the way he feels because I've taught him well. He's 10 and a feminist. I'm so proud.
Oh my God.
I love that.
Smashing the patriarchy with unicorns is pretty much the future that I want.
That's the future liberals want, or this liberal wants. That's amazing. And I love that. I mean, I definitely grapple with having a son. And even though my son's only 3, but like kind of raising him in a feminist environment. And I know that there's a lot of outside factors that I can't control, like friends and TV and,
like teachers.
Yeah. So
everyone in the community.
Exactly. So it's definitely something I grapple with. So it's so awesome that you have a 10-year-old feminist. And I love that.
And you've made such an impact.
Okay, Sarah, so it's Thursday, so it's time for our favorite segment of the week. It's the Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. So what has Queen Maxine been up to?
Yeah, she's been up to a lot. She's very busy. So first of all, news came out that Maxine has been added to the list of honorees at BET's 2017 Black Girls Rock Awards.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she'll earn the Social Humanitarian Award for, quote, being a fearless and outspoken advocate for underserved populations. And in accepting the award, she said, quote, I want you to know if it was not for the love and respect shown to me by Black women, those right-wing ultra-conservatives, they would have me believe I'm too Black, I'm too confrontational, I'm too tough, and I'm too disrespectful of them. But now I know I'm simply a strong Black woman. I don't care how big you are. I don't care how high you are. If you come for me, I'm coming for you.
I'm fanning myself.
I know. She's so great. So the event already took place last Saturday, and it will air on TV on August 22nd.
Which is also the day that something bad is supposed to happen to Trump.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say
that. So for those who don't know the context, I'm in this, like, liberal women's group. I'm in a lot of, like, random, like, political Facebook groups, and one of them, like, months ago, I think in, like, January, was, like, she went to some convention with a bunch of, like, psychics, and apparently they all agree that something big, not necessarily
big.
Fair. Something big is going to happen to Trump on August 22nd, and so I don't know that I necessarily believe in it, but I definitely put a calendar, calendar reminder on August 22nd, and part of me is hoping that something happens.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So she also made time to chat with Chris Hayes, who, as R. Eric Thomas calls him, the, quote, bespeckled boo, about the grand jury news. She said, quote, Mueller is going to win, and he was like, you seem very confident, and in true Maxine form, she was like, I do.
Yeah.
Thank you for noticing.
She was like, yes, Chris Hayes. Like,
I am confident.
Yeah. Like,
also, I'm going to refer to Chris Hayes as bespeckled boo always.
Bespeckled boo. It's so great. It's funny, too, when you watch the clip, you see his eyebrows raise. Like, he's never prepared for, like, the fire that she brings. It's like, Chris Hayes, are you new here?
Right.
Like, you've had her on the show, like, quite a bit.
Like, she basically lives there. So, like,
it's,
come on.
It's really funny to see his reaction. Maxine also appeared on The View, where she told the hosts in regards to White House leakers on those phone conversations with world leaders, so that the transcripts got leaked. She said, quote, I'm so glad that they're telling us what's going on. And then she continued, this is Trump's problem. He's in a White House where he's got people working for him who don't believe in him, don't like what he's doing, and they're trying to tell the American public about it. And we sort of alluded to that similar point on Monday, where it's like, leaks are kind of normal and typical of any administration, but this many really shows that the people working for him don't have confidence in him.
Exactly.
And, you know, some people, which is a fair counterpoint, are like, well, should we be, like, there are national security concerns.
Right.
Like, is this going to happen to future presidents? And she basically was like, no, he's an abnormal president.
That's true.
Why this is happening. And these are not normal times. So I think it's okay for us to not operate normally either.
Right. Absolutely.
And, you know, she reminded us on AM Joy that Trump himself, lest we forget, has leaked information about one of our allies to an adversary, Russia.
Right.
Like, he did that.
Right. So, I mean, it's really unfair for him to do that and then be like, but you can't really, like...
Yeah, like, come
rich.
On.
Rich. Yeah. Really rich.
Again, abnormal situation, abnormal president. We can't pretend like the normal rules apply.
Well, because they
don't.
None
of them do.
I mean, obviously, like, a lot of our democratic norms are being just ignored.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're playing by different rules now.
Yep.
So Queen Maxine also spoke out on Sessions's possibly going after reporters. She tweeted, quote, Trump can't use DOJ to subpoena news outlets that debunk his lies. DOJ and Intel should focus more on Trump's leaks to Russians and Junior's emails.
I love
it's basically
that.
Like, keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah. Like, no. Like, don't... Like, you're going to try to go after leakers.
Not useful.
You should focus more on, like, Trump actually leaking to the Russians. And right. And also, like...
Don Jr.'s
emails.
Lest we forget that blip on the radar.
Oh, it's so wild.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to the Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. And again, she really wins it every week. So our first honorable... Our only honorable mention, and then we have our winner... So our honorable mention is Yashar Ali. We've talked about him on the podcast before, but he is the freelance reporter that broke that Eric Bolling sexual harassment story in the Huffington Post that we talked about in the last podcast. Apparently, Bolling has hit back and is suing Yashar personally for $50 million.
Okay.
And Yashar gets this honorable mention because he responded to the news by tweeting, quote, "Just received a summons. I stand by my reporting and will protect my sources. Not going to stop reporting on Eric Bolling or anyone else. I've had family members killed/jailed in Iran, so a lawsuit isn't going to scare me."
Like, yeah.
That is a pretty badass response.
It's a pretty badass thing to say.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Bolling's lawyers didn't name Huffington Post, which is where the article appeared, in the suit, but the editor-in-chief, Lydia Polgreen, tweeted, "Yashar Ali is a paid freelancer under contract with HuffPost. We have no hesitation about standing by him financially in this case."
Yeah, and remember, when we talked about the story, Yashar had 14 sources.
Right, this is not like three, like normal, reporting. We're in an era of 14 fucking sources.
14 sources. Also, this lawsuit opens Bolling and Fox up to all kinds of sort of potential discovery findings, so it could definitely blow up in this guy's face.
That would, like, Schadenfreude.
Like, didn't think about a long-term strategy here, like, was just reacting. And apparently, I think he's retained someone from, like, one of Trump's, like, a Trump law firm.
Oh, good.
I have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's what people were saying.
I'm interested to see how this plays out, because Schadenfreude is real, y'all.
Yeah.
And then our winner this week is Little Miss Flint.
Oh,
so she,
love her.
I know. I think she was an Action Item not too long ago.
We had an Action Item around her, and I think it was around this thing. We're giving her, and she's also, I believe, been an honorable mention and or an award winner.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But this time, she partnered with the nonprofit organization Pack Your Back on Sunday for a school supply distribution in her hometown of Flint, Michigan. So last year, she started the hashtag Pack Your Back Challenge on Twitter and was able to fill 100 backpacks with school supplies. She did 10 times that amount this year.
Yeah, so 1,000 backpacks.
1,000 backpacks to every single student that came to the event. Little Miss Flint also raised around $10,000 online. So all the students within the city of Flint, which still faces this long-term public health crisis due to its ongoing water issues, have a serious need for school supplies. Little Miss Flint told the Huffington Post, "I wanted to make sure that the kids got the best start possible to this school year and for their parents to not have to worry about buying supplies. I'm a Flint kid that wants to help all the other Flint kids."
I love this in so many ways because A, it shows that you're never too young to get involved politically. And she has said herself, "I will be president. I'm running for president." And
people are
like, "Oh, that's adorable."
She's like, it's not adorable. I'm going to be president.
And so you're never too young to get involved. You're never too young to make an impact, and especially locally. So we really tip our caps to Little Miss Flint because this is awesome, and she's making a great contribution to her community. All right, Devin. So that was a lot. Packed show. So let's get into some action items. What's the first action item we have?
Okay, so the first thing you can do is support the mosque that was bombed in Bloomington, Minnesota. It was Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center. They have a GoFundMe and a goal of $95,000, and they've raised $87,000 so far.
Yeah.
So you can find the donation page at gofundme.com/support-dar-al-farouq-center. We'll put that on the show notes. And every contribution really counts, so please show your support and help them rebuild.
Yeah, that's a really good cause. Courtesy of our friends from Indivisible Guide, they have recess.indivisibleguide.com. On the microsite, they say, "August is time for congressional recess. It's time for your activism on your home turf. Get prepared, get the resources, hit the streets and town halls, hold your members of Congress accountable, and take back our democracy. So there's a tool on there for you to search for and register events in your area. It's a really awesome way to get involved locally during August recess. And I will say, I called Senator Harris's office because she doesn't have an event page on her Senate website. And I was like, hey, when can I see Kamala?
Yeah.
Like, I want to talk to her.
Yeah.
And they don't have any public events yet. So you can obviously always call your reps.
Right.
But this is a really great resource. It has like a centralized centralized hub of events.
Yeah. And then finally, we want to give a shout out to one of our Hellions, Hannah, who is recovering from some pretty significant surgery and has been in some pain.
Yeah.
So we're thinking of you and sending healing thoughts your way. And she actually runs a healthcare indivisible group.
Yes.
And you should follow her on Twitter. She does great advocacy work there. And she's actually helped us understand some of the more nuances and untangle some of the healthcare policy.
Complexities. It is really a complex issue, and she is masterful at it.
Yes.
So you should definitely follow her healthcare indivisible group on Twitter. They're caring for us. So it's @caring. _4FOR and then _us. She does really great work. So Hannah, we're thinking of you, and we're sending you lots of healing thoughts, like
yes.
Devin said, your way. And we're really looking forward to you getting back into the groove of things, because you are sorely missed.
You are. Okay, so that's it for us for today. It has been one hell of a week.
another long Thursday show. I'm accepting the things I cannot change.
Yeah,
there are too much Trump land bullshit.
There is. So we also want to thank Melissa McEwen again, and we will see you back here on Monday.
And if you're a Patreon contributor, we'll see you on Patreon. We'll have a bonus podcast ahead of the weekend.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed, as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram @HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. Thank you.